Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga.
It is only going to be accessible to either the VIPs or their children. So that means what they are simply saying is that the life of an ordinary Zimbabwean is not important, but only the life of a VIP is the one that is important.
Mixed reactions in Zimbabwe as the state supports the construction of a medical facility for highly placed individuals.
Every day, elite mayors, people are going to help these ex-fighters. They don't only give them material things, they counsel them. You see how very young, vibrant and dynamic ex-fighters are struggling every day with us to appeal to the others in the bush to come to have peace.
Cameroon turns public buildings on its northern border with Nigeria into temporary housing for former Boko Haram militants.
Faut dire que l'action de Hometer est très très tellement noble.
What Hometer is doing is very noble and should be saluted, he says. The desert is advancing rapidly into the Sahel, and they're taking on the challenge of recovering a lot of land and allowing animals and people to live properly.
And a Belgian African company operating in Burkina Faso plants trees to help curb desertification and open land for grazing cattle and farming. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. COVID-19 restrictions are not just keeping students out of the classroom, but also out of the laboratory. The University of Johannesburg is helping students replicate the experience through virtual reality. Linda Givtash reports from Johannesburg.
Wearing headsets in front of large TV screens, a group of South African students appear to be playing video games. But they actually are deepening their knowledge of science. The virtual reality hub that is part of the University of Johannesburg's Faculty of Education helps students get up close to atoms, cells, and viruses. Mafor Penn is completing her PhD in science and technology education.
Students are learning in a more interactive way, in a more immersive way. It's more engaging in that they are able to visualize microscientific phenomena. They are able to interact with these phenomena. And you can actually repeat that over and over. It's one of the greatest benefits of learning in this way.
Even before the pandemic made South Africa the continent's hotspot, students' laboratory time was limited, but not in the virtual world. The university developed a VR set inspired by Google Cardboard that costs less than $20 and works with any smartphone. Sekile Macholi is a third-year education student.
I can use what I've been provided with at the comfort of my couch at home. So you can just go to YouTube. You can use your device, your smartphone, if it's compatible with the apps. And then you can actually view cells or whatever science concept that you are studying at that moment.
VR isn't just helping students study STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. It's also gearing up this next generation of teachers to use technology to boost STEM in poorer primary and secondary schools. Professor Amresh Ramnarain heads the Department of Science Education at the University of Johannesburg.
Learners who come from a very much impoverished backgrounds where schools are in disadvantaged communities where they don't have fully fitted laboratories. And unfortunately, because of those learning experiences that they have in STEM education, it has not inspired learners at school to pursue tertiary studies.
The shortfalls became apparent when pandemic lockdown sent students home. Schools scrambled to adopt distance learning technology. But as students return to the classroom, educators like Ramnarain say the pandemic's changes to learning will stick around.
The future of learning is actually blended learning or hybrid learning, whereby we are going to blend face-to-face interaction. So students, there will be dedicated sessions whereby students will attend class, but that is going to be blended now with virtual online learning. I do not believe that we're going to go back to as we were.
University of Johannesburg is working with South Africa's Education Ministry to bring VR devices to public schools. If the program proves successful, it hopes to replicate it across the country and around the continent. Linda Givtash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Zimbabwe, Finance Minister Mithuli Ncube recently announced that the state is supporting the construction of a medical facility for highly placed individuals. The news has caused consternation among citizens who must make do with inadequate medical facilities which are overstretched by the COVID-19 pandemic and a lack of equipment. Adegondo has more on the story.
The hospital, which is nearing completion, is situated at the Manyami Air Force Base and costs $270 million to build. The finance minister revealed that the facility will cater to service chiefs and to what he calls VVIPs, or very, very important people. It is ostensibly meant to curtail the individuals from going overseas for expensive medical treatments. Health Minister Constantino Chiwenga, who is also the country's vice president, is on record as saying those trips gobble up millions of dollars. In the same statement, which has been widely reported in news outlets, the minister said that the government has allocated $400 million to the refurbishment of medical facilities around the country. But critics say even that amount of money is not enough given the decrepit condition of the country's small number of public health facilities where the need is more urgent. In previous interviews with VOA, medical staff associations have decried the lack of equipment, protective wear, and medicines in the medical facilities. Critics say that economically hard-pressed citizens are not even able to afford the services. In interviews with VOA, Zimbabweans reacted with dismay to the construction of the new VVIP hospital, describing the development as brazen and elitist. Notando Ncube, a 29-year-old mother of one, shares her experiences upon visiting two of the country's largest medical facilities, United Bulawayo Hospital and Mpilo, the biggest in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe's second-largest city.
Why waste so much money building such a hospital when you can actually use them, when it's actually for VIPs instead of using it for, you know, helping people in need of it? You find that enough places like people like are not really attended, and you find that nurses just peek in through the window. They don't even get inside to look at what is happening with people that are suffering from COVID. And then you find that maybe it's because they lack the equipment of like attending those people, so they're even scared of like catching the disease, right? No, I feel like that's very so. As I'm talking right now, there are no blankets. You get there, you have a cold night, they tell you the blankets are not enough.
Another resident of Bulawayo, Baki Dube, says that he has had to foot the medical bills of some of his relatives on his meagre salary as a teacher, and that the building of the new medical facility for elites is highly insensitive given the state of the country's hospitals, which he calls death traps.
The healthy workers, they are very demotivated, such that they do not see any reason whatsoever why they should be jumping up to save life. And secondly, getting there actually, there is no medication. So when you get to the hospitals, those people at the hospitals, they refer you to the pharmacies. In order for you to buy medication at the pharmacies, nothing is needed but Forex, which you do not earn anyway. The fact that it is at Manyami Air Base, where there are soldiers heavily guarded, it means that it will not be accessible to the ordinary public person. You see, it is only going to be accessible to either the VIPs or their children. So that means what they are simply saying is that the life of an ordinary Zimbabwean is not important, but only the life of a VIP is the one that is important.
Sociopolitical analyst Effie Ncube says that the building of the new facility was ill-advised.
There is a huge challenge in Zimbabwe of access to medical attention, because government has left the medical institutions to die down, to crumble out of existence. So what they should be doing, instead of building a private hospital for the government officials, they should be plowing that money into resuscitating the health infrastructure in form of major referral hospitals, your district hospitals, your provincial hospitals, going down to your district clinics.
Some government supporters on social media echo the government's claim that the move will save the country money by curtailing medical tourism abroad. But Ncube and other observers say giving well-connected individuals preferential treatment in PACS is a further indication of the alienation of the Zimbabwean government from the citizenry. Reporting for VOA, this is Adegondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe. the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll explore the politics of mental health. What do our cultural attitudes towards it say about the societies we live in? We'll bring you the stories of refugees in Uganda who are speaking out about their mental health, and we'll have expert analysis on why African governments need a long-term agenda for mental health care. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Cameroon has turned public buildings on its northern border with Nigeria into temporary housing for former Boko Haram militants. Hundreds of Boko Haram members have been defecting from the Islamic group. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon says its Center for Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration, or DDR in Méry, a northern town on the border with Nigeria, is now home to about 1,500 former Boko Haram militants. 3 weeks ago, the center had about 750 former militants. DDR officials in Méry said Tuesday most of the 237 former jihadist members who arrived this week included women and children. 100 are former Boko Haram fighters, all looking tired, unkempt, and hungry, officials said. 33-year-old Alidu Faizar says he defected from a Boko Haram camp in the Sambisa forest, located on the Cameroon-Nigeria border. He says he is tired of killing and looting, and that Boko Haram promised to improve his living conditions when he joined the jihadist group 3 years ago. But he is now poorer, and that he suffers from a guilty conscience, reminding him of crimes he committed. He adds that peace is priceless. Faizar said his wish is to return to Abadam, a town in Nigeria's Borno State. Cameroon says close to 900 of the 1,500 former jihadists in Méry are Nigerians. Omar Bishai, director of the DDR Center at Méry, says the center is already at full capacity with former Boko Haram members.
Notre centre provisoire de Méry est déjà saturé. Nous avons été amenés.
He says Cameroon's government has turned public buildings, including a women's empowerment center at Mora, another northern town, into temporary residences for Boko Haram members. He says the governor of Cameroon's far north region has suggested that his colleagues in Nigeria's Borno State, considered an epicenter of the jihadist group, should make arrangements for the former militants to voluntarily return to Nigeria. Francis Fayengo, the DDR country director, says Cameroonian President Paul Biya has allocated funds for the construction of a DDR center that can host 1,500 former militants in Méry, a town located in north along the border with Nigeria. He says Cameroon is grateful that many militants are escaping from Boko Haram camps.
We have to thank ex-fighters for laying down their arms. I'm sure that they looked at the bigger picture, which is to have peace. Every day, elite mayors, people are going to help these ex-fighters. They don't only give them material things, they counsel them. You see how very young, vibrant, and dynamic ex-fighters are struggling every day with us to appeal to the others in the bush to come to have peace.
Yengo said Cameroon's president has asked that all fighters who dropped their weapons to be pardoned and reintegrated back into society. He said Nigerians who want to return to their country will be handed to Nigerian government authorities, but did not say when. The Multinational Joint Task Force of the Lake Chad Basin, or MNGTF, that is fighting the jihadist group, says Nigeria has been informed that many ex-fighters have surrendered in Cameroon and want to return to Nigeria. The task force is made up of troops from Niger, Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria. Nigeria is yet to issue a statement on the possibility of the former militants returning to the West African state. Cameroon's military said the militants surrendered to MNGTF troops stationed at the border around Sambisa Forest. The task force said many militants have been defecting in Cameroon, Nigeria and Chad following the death of Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau. The jihadist group leader was declared killed in May. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The UN and activists in Malawi have condemned ongoing attacks against albinos after an albino man's body was discovered with limbs missing. Albinos are killed in some remote areas of Africa because of the false belief that their body parts have magical properties. Lameka Masina reports from Blantyre in Malawi.
Police say the death of 21-year-old Ian Muhammad in the Kachere area of Blantyre brings the number of albino attacks this year to 4, a drop from past years, but still disconcerting. 3 victims, including Muhammad, have been killed, while another, a baby girl, is missing. James Kadadzera is a spokesperson for the Malawi Police Service.
The first incident this year in Mangochi, the suspects were arrested and the body was also found. Another incident in Chihuahua where a baby, 20 months old, was abducted, we are on ground investigating that one. And we are sure of finding the suspects. We are sure of finding the whereabouts of the abducted baby.
Kadadzera also said police are investigating the death of Muhammad. Statistics show that since 2014, more than 170 albinos have been attacked in Malawi because of false beliefs that concoctions mixed with their body parts bring luck and wealth. In some cases, grave robbers have exhumed corpses to retrieve albinos' bodies. Observers say efforts to end the attacks haven't helped much. In 2018, the government and the United Nations developed the National Action Plan on Persons with Albinism. The plan is designed to discourage attacks and provide albinos with greater protection, in part by giving out security alarms. Maria Jose Torres is the UN National Coordinator in Malawi. She says full implementation of the plan could help end the attacks.
The United Nations is asking the authorities to continue implementing the National Action Plan on Persons with Albinism to ensure that the criminal practice of attacking persons with albinism is fully eliminated in Malawi.
Boniface Massa is chairperson for the Disability and Elderly Rights Directorate at the Malawi Human Rights Commission, a key stakeholder in the action plan. He says the plan, for its promises, is falling short.
We so far highlighted the serious gaps in terms of the actual protection pillar under National Action Plan. So overall, what we noted from our findings and that we're still analyzing is that there hasn't been a direct impact on the life of a person with albinism.
In a statement this week, Amnesty International said the recent attack is the latest reminder that Malawi remains a dangerous place for persons with albinism. Some rights activists believe the attacks could end only if police mount a crackdown on markets for their albino body parts. But police spokesperson Kadadzera says there is no such market.
There are a lot of people that were arrested with the bones, and they don't have anywhere to sell the bones. So that's why I'm saying this is just a mystery. This is a belief that is unfounded.
He said in the meantime, police, chiefs, and religious leaders are trying to educate people to stop believing in the myths that perpetrate the attacks. Lameck Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
A Belgian African company operating in Burkina Faso is planting trees to help curb desertification and open lands for grazing cattle and farming. Man and Earth is the company behind the project that's taking place in the country's dangerous conflict zones, where expanding desertification is a cause for strife. Henry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou.
Africa's Sahel region has sometimes been referred to as the canary in the coal mine, capturing early warnings of danger when it comes to the impact of climate change. Now, a Belgian-African company that goes by its French name, Homme et Terre, or Men and Earth, is working to curb desert expansion by planting trees and making land usable again in some of Burkina Faso's most conflict-affected areas. Yves Douche is Homme et Terre's program director. She says more people are talking about climate change as something that falls on them and that humans are all responsible for it. There are many things we can do to reduce logging, to control animal grazing, to protect young trees, to improve farming and forestry techniques, to make better use of what we have, she added. The Sahara Desert, which skirts the Sahel to the south, has expanded by 10% over the past 100 years, according to a National Science Foundation study. As land for growing crops and rearing livestock becomes scarcer, it is causing intercommunal violence in countries like Burkina Faso. The violence has contributed to a six-year conflict between the Burkinabe government and groups linked to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda terrorist organizations. One Homme et Terre worker, who spoke on condition of anonymity, out of concern for his safety, says life had been very hard in his community before the project began. He says things were difficult because there was no work. Farming was not that beneficial. They also tried to find small jobs in livestock as well. By planting trees, locals can make money from producing oil, nuts and seeds. Trees also make the ground fertile again, which means it can be used for farming or raising livestock. But in an often hostile environment where terrorist attacks happen almost daily, Homme et Terre's operations are risky. Another Homme et Terre worker, who also requested anonymity, say community leaders they worked with have lost their lives in violent attacks.
Comme on appelle ça, comme vous avez tout à l'heure présenté nos conseils stratégiques.
He says initially there were six strategic advisors working for the company, and now there are four, he added, asking if visiting VOA reporters have noticed the difference. Two have been killed since last year. May they rest in peace, he said. Yet those involved with Homme et Terre believe their work is important.
Faut dire que l'action de Homme et Terre est très tellement noble.
What Homme et Terre is doing is very noble and should be saluted, he says. The desert is advancing rapidly into the Sahel, and they're taking on the challenge of recovering a lot of land and allowing animals and people to live properly. Unlike many international organizations with a stated mission of improving lives in Burkina Faso's countryside, Homme et Terre is run for profit. The company says its purpose in restoring degraded land is to foster profitable and sustainable agroforestry in collaboration with local communities. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
Bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
We are here at Kalerwe Market, Uganda, Kampala, where in this whole market, women are crying out for their situation to change.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
We hear your voices. Women's voices, our voices, and add your voice to the conversation each week right here on the Voice of America. Check your local TV listings.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Netline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, sports, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. And now in Nightline Africa Sports, African football's governing body, CAF, has asked the United Kingdom government to exempt African international footballers from its travel restrictions to allow them to travel to next week's World Cup qualifiers. Current UK rules designed to limit the spread of coronavirus mean that countries on the British Red List, including several African nations, are unable to call on players based in the Premier League for international matches. CAF, acting on behalf of all African member associations, African players and fans, has urged the British government to urgently provide the required exemptions to enable African players to compete for their countries in the upcoming FIFA World Cup Qatar 2020 qualifiers. CAF notes that similar exemptions were granted by the British government to enable the attendance of delegations and officials, among others, at the finals of the European Championship held less than 2 months ago. CAF further notes that the circumstances in the African countries on the red list in many cases are in fact less severe than other countries not currently on this list or for which exemptions were previously provided. CAF says that the upcoming matches will be delivered under the strict protocols developed by FIFA and applied across the world, as was the case in previous windows and in continental tournaments successfully delivered without any incidents. And in light of the above, CAF has appealed as a matter of urgency to the Football Association and the British government that the same treatment previously applied to Europe now be extended to Africa under the principles of solidarity and equal treatment. And in beach soccer, reigning African champions, the Lions from Senegal, ousted Brazil last Thursday to clinch a historic semi-final ticket in the FIFA Beach Soccer World Cup Russia 2021. After beating Uruguay 6-1 and Portugal 5-2, and despite a defeat in their third game against Oman 2-3 in the group stage, the Lions, more determined than ever, have launched to attack in the quarterfinals the five-time world champion Brazil. In the fiercely contested game, Ngala Selam's men took the upper hand, winning 5-4 after extra time, a victory which makes Senegal the first African nation to reach this stage of the competition. Win of the Beach Soccer Africa Cup of Nations in 2016, 2018 and 2021, the country of Teranga confirms the progression that started several years ago. After the elimination of Mozambique, Senegal remained the sole African representative in the competition and intend to play their cards until the end, according to officials. And in rugby, Queensland has been deemed safe to host all four nations. New Zealand and Australia are currently subject to lockdowns, and All Blacks cancelled two games last week. The new fixtures will be double headers over four weekends from September 12th. The championships kicked off at Eden Park in New Zealand on 14th August with the hosts thrashing the Wallabies 57-22. South Africa then hosted two games against Argentina, winning both to top the table before the competition was thrown into jeopardy as New Zealand's snap lockdown after first coronavirus case in 6 months led to cancellations. Three venues in Queensland will now stage the forthcoming rounds, except for the Australia-New Zealand game, which is still set for Perth, albeit with a date yet to be confirmed. The Gold Coast will host New Zealand versus Argentina and Australia versus South Africa in a back-to-back doubleheader on September 12th in round three, as well as the round six ties. The other rounds will be played in Brisbane and Townsville. And that's about it for this edition of Netline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict and in time of peace. Here is one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Practitioners of the peaceful settlement of disputes have always maintained that the search for early warning and measures to tackle those are vital to the settlement of disputes. Unfortunately, this mantra is often ignored. For example, if you look at the deteriorating relationship between Morocco and Algeria, you could see early warning signs that they are drifting towards serious conflict. We can look at possibilities, but it is now necessary to assess what is the cause of these disputes. Recently, of course, Algeria has accused Morocco for calling of igniting forest fires, and Morocco has raised old border disputes. What is now of major importance is to take note that developments outside the control of these two countries have exacerbated their problem. As you may recall, former President Trump, in pursuit of a diplomatic victory prior to the last elections in the United States, promoted reconciliation between Israel and a number of Arab states, including two in Africa, Morocco and the Sudan. Former President Trump, challenging basic agreement to understanding in the Security Council, in which it is a member, decided to recognize Morocco's full sovereignty in Western Sahara. And this encouraged reconciliation between Morocco and Israel. But that decision has its own consequences. So-called foreign policy experts, particularly in the West, have often argued that violation of foreign policy principles may need certain repercussions. But often, those paying these repercussions or consequences are usually small and medium-sized states, but seldom major powers. But in this particular case of Morocco, there are certain unforeseen consequences. Youths in Algeria, and some say even in Morocco, have not been too pleased at the way the people of Western Sahara have been treated. The Polisario has stopped fighting and entered into negotiations with Morocco. But the referendum promised by the Security Council had not been carried out because of differences of who should participate in such a referendum. And therefore, pressure has been brought on the government of Algeria, for example, and certain reports say that both the Polisario and many in Algeria believe perhaps a confrontation might develop. If you think these issues are enough to cause problem, you have to understand yet another unforeseen issue were connected to it has also brought problems for these two countries. Some will also say that out of the blues, the head of the Commission of the African Union had granted observer status to the State of Israel. Let me say right now that the opposition to this act by Mr. Saki has nothing to do with antipathy towards the State of Israel. We are far removed from those days in 1973 when, after the Yom Kippur War, almost all African states broke diplomatic relations with Israel. Today, Israel has been successful in improving its relations with almost all African states, and these relationships are now stable. But states like South Africa and others are wanting to know under what authority Mr. Saki has offered this observer status, which in fact will give to Israel important political leverage within the African Union. It is reminiscent of the dispute which arose during the July 1980 OAU summit in Sierra Leone, when some member states questioned the maneuvering of the then Secretary General of the OAU, Mr. Kodjo, and which also resulted in the endorsement of the Sahrawi People's Republic as the representative of the people of the Sahrawi, and they became a member of the OAU, and later, under the push of the African group, was able to obtain observer status in the United Nations. So the question then is, how should this matter be resolved? If it is resolved, and the reason being, because Israel being an observer status, we give it important political leverage within the African Union. So there's an urgent need to look at these early warning signs and try to resolve an issue which some suspect may result in armed conflict between the two countries. Otherwise, most instability will arise in North Africa. As we have seen recently, Tunisia, once stable, is now embroiled with domestic instability. And the issue of Libya has remained unresolved. After NATO involvement in Libya, nothing has been given to Libya except trouble. And the efforts to bring about reconciliation has not worked. Perhaps maybe in December. So this is a warning that the African Union, the United Nations, to begin to pay greater attention to the relationship between Algeria and Morocco. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday here on Headline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Love is a drug, and I'm addicted. Pull up, show up, and handle business. Love is a drug, and I'm addicted. Pull up, show up, and handle business.
Give me love, baby, give me make I calm down. Give me love, 'cause I really need it right now.
drug and I'm addicted. Pull up, show up and handle business. The love is a drug and I'm addicted. Pull up, show up and handle business. The love is a drug and I'm addicted. Pull up, show up.
I'm giving you love. mina kutamani nikupeleke nyumbani lali lali.
Say it like you really mean it. Everything you
And that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Have a very good evening.